Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Kevin Baker's new novel, The Big Crowd, is inspired by the wife of William O'Dwyer. O'Dwyer left Ireland for New York at age 20, abandoning studies for the priesthood to be a Brooklyn cop. He won the mayor's seat in 1946. For four golden years, he was immensely popular with every immigrant group in the city, including his own Irish, Italians, and Jewish Americans. But after his ties to mafia dons were revealed, he left the city. Harry Truman appointed him ambassador to Mexico, where he lived until his death 10 years later. Kevin Baker is also the author of three novels set in turn-of-the-century New York, Dreamland, Paradise Alley, and Stryver's Row. It's a great pleasure to welcome Kevin Baker to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What is the lore for you of old New York?
Well, it was what the old TV show used to say, 8 million stories in the Naked City. There really are tremendous, amazing stories out there. You know, this one, the mayor of New York basically has to flee to Mexico because he's implicated in the greatest unsolved mob murder in our history, with his wife, who's the hottest fashion model in the country, and who in Mexico gets very bored and takes up bullfighting. You know, you can't really make this stuff up. In fact, at times you have to kind of hone it down. But beyond that, though, New York is sort of the real heartland of America, I think. This is really the most kind of fought over place in our history as to who is going to be a full American and what that means.
In choosing William O'Dwyer, what was it about this character that you said, okay, I can invest this many pages in this character for a novel?
Well, he's really an intriguing character and a very sympathetic character in many ways. As you said, he really comes to America with nothing. He had tried to be a priest but didn't like that. So he did all kinds of things. He carried the hod, carried bricks up to the highest levels of the Woolworth Building, you know, tended bar, became a cop, walked the Red Hook waterfronts, the kind of the toughest waterfront in New York, studies at night, becomes a lawyer, becomes a magistrate's judge, very much on the side of the people, won't put strikers in jail during the Depression, and then becomes the crusading DA of Brooklyn, of Kings County, and sends seven members of Murder Incorporated, the notorious mob outfit, to the dance hall, which is what they called the electric chair row in Sing Sing. You know, it's a great American success story. It's the classic American dream. And yet, in the end, it all kind of crumbles before us. It all ends up being at least somewhat false. And that to me is just a tremendously interesting thing.
So your novel is very much a story of brothers, though.
Yes. Also, it's in the novel, he has a younger brother, Tom O'Kane, who's based very much on the actual William O'Dwyer's younger brother, Paul O'Dwyer, who was a New York icon for many years, the last fighting liberal. He ran guns to the IRA, ran guns to the Haganah, worked very hard for civil rights, for Puerto Rican rights in the city. You know, was in every cause, always running for election, always kind of carrying the banner. So it really struck me as, you know, this was fascinating to me. Why is, you know, what is the relationship between this very idealistic younger brother and his very compromised older brother? And I wanted to explore what that, you know, how that might have gone, what they might have been thinking behind the scenes.
So how much of what you write, because these are, you're not writing about William O'Dwyer. It is inspired by that. These are fictional constructs. So how much of you, the writer, in wanting to tell a great story that you want to educate as well and give a little bit about the history of these amazing characters?
Yeah, it's well, you know, it's, and that's sort of the thing, the fine line that historical fiction works. You know, it's not the exact story. You know, I have, for instance, there's an affair in this between Tom O'Kane, the younger brother, and and Charlie O'Kane's wife, you know, Slim Sadler in the book. Sloane Simpson was O'Dwyer's actual second wife. You know, there's no indication that actually happened. So there are certain things you make up, and there's certain things you speculate on. For instance, one of the things I wanted to speculate on was how the central mob murder in this took place, this actual murder where a famous, probably the most famous or most successful government mob witness of all time, the second Kid Twist, a guy named Abe Relis, ends up being thrown out of a sixth-story window while under 18-man round-the-clock police guard on Coney Island. And that's still, you know, still unknown. So to a certain degree, there's a fictional element in kind of speculating about that. But at the same time, it's a very much a meditation on what really happened, not only in this relationship between brothers and in this kind of compromised mayor, but also in what New York was and what it was becoming at that moment after the war.
This becomes very clear in reading the novel to the extent of your research, but I have to say that when you start looking at the back of the book, of on sources and acknowledgments, there's a lot there.
Yeah, I always like to credit people like you because I really rely on them for the research. But it's a tremendously interesting era and a tremendously interesting scandal. This is really the first big televised scandal ever. This is the first time you have the Senate out there talking about this, you know, and grilling somebody under the lights. And it fascinated Americans and New Yorkers. I mean, New York, they actually had to put ads in the papers, the department stores, reminding women to go out and shop for Easter because they were just glued to their TV sets. The movie theaters started showing the hearings for free, just desperately trying to get somebody out again. But it's amazing to me that it's so forgotten now. This really was kind of the biggest scandal that had ever happened at that moment.
Do you think that a lot of it has to do with that we are used to political scandal, that it has become sort of a regular sport? Although we're still interested in it, we're still fascinated, it still sells newspapers.
Sure. What made it so mesmerizing, I think, was the fact that it was on TV. You know, people weren't that naive, particularly people who lived in cities. They knew there was a lot of corruption. They knew things went on behind the scenes. But they had never seen this dragged out on TV before. And then again, it also involved the mob. So that was that's always a sure, sure attention getter.
We think of many of us who have roots in journalism think of this period, especially in New York, as being a golden age. So were you able, with wonderful writers who were chronicling what was happening in the city, so did you benefit from that?
Oh, yeah, terrific writers. I mean, the guy who broke the scandal, this guy, Malcolm Mike Johnson, who was Haynes Johnson's father, and he wins this Pulitzer about breaking, not particularly this, but breaking a lot of these scandals that were going on the waterfront and were related to this killing. And they run 24 front-page pieces on the cover of the old New York Sun as it's dying. He wins the Pulitzer Prize for this, and then the paper collapses. But, you know, there's a lot of terrific writing about this sort of thing going on at the time. Terrific magazine pieces on this in places like Collier's, wonderful old magazine, run these huge in-depth articles that are sadly all gone now.
In the context, how did you want to weave in the Kefauver hearings and make that such a large part of the novel?
Well, I just wanted to kind of get across like how this is indicative of the changing America and changing New York. You know, part of what was going on was when O'Dwyer, or Kane in the novel, becomes mayor, he's still thinking in terms of New York as a place that is run, it has to be run, by a small group of ruthless men, the big crowd. And he hands over a tremendous amount of power to those men. And what he's not grasping, and what they're not grasping, is that now this is a different America, a different New York, after the war, after the reforms of the New Deal. People don't depend on the old political machines anymore. They can't be bossed by any group of people the way they used to be. And TV, in a way, is this, you know, the perfect medium for this new age. It's this thing, it's in everybody's house. It's completely enrapturing, you know. It just draws people right to it. And, you know, these people are dragged out before the screen. O'Dwyer, in reality, ended up looking terrible on TV. He had the flu while he was up there. They had these very hot lights. And so he's constantly, like, patting his forehead and sweating. He looks guilty as sin just from the appearances, which is a little unfair. But, you know, this is how it went. I mean, there was a famous thing. In those days, they would ask you if you would allow your face to be shown on the hearings. And the lawyers for the leading gangster, the leading mobster in New York who's there, Frank Costello, who follows after O'Dwyer, say, no, you can't show his face. So instead, the cameras focus on his hands while he's testifying, and you see them kind of constantly wringing his hands, tearing up small pieces of paper, doing this. And so this reveals the man more than even a lot of what he's saying. You know, suddenly this whole fabric of political corruption that was very intense in New York at the time is ripped open.
In reading the novel, you can't help but think that this was a rehearsal for McCarthyism and the hearings.
Oh, very much in a way. I mean, the Kefauver Committee was run by Estes Kefauver, this very ambitious senator from Tennessee, and he really thought of, you know, the mob as his issue. He's going to, you know, McCarthy had communism. He's going after the mob. And there were all kinds of crazily exaggerated things said about the mob's influence. But the mob was there, much more than McCarthy's communists were, and they were doing all these sort of things, and they had this great influence. Particularly at that moment, they had made all this money off Prohibition. So traditionally, the politicians in New York had controlled the gangsters. With Prohibition, that equation gets reversed, and now the mobsters are controlling the politicians as they never had before and never would afterwards. You know, the 1950 special mayoral election after O'Dwyer goes to Mexico is described as the Lucchese family money against the Genovese family money. They're running these two candidates against each other, and it's really, you know, deeply corrupt. It doesn't last, but it's, you know, there's all this sort of mafia influence going on.
You're listening to The Book Show. Our guest this week is Kevin Baker, author of the new novel, The Big Crowd. When you think about all that this character is going through, and his brother is right there,
right,
and is ultimately determined to clear his name.
Yes, and that was what the real Paul O'Dwyer believed, too. He never believed a word of anything said against his brother, no matter what the evidence. In the book, the Tom O'Kane character is a little more open to things. But again, he really feels his brother is innocent. He feels he's been railroaded to Mexico, where he's now, after his ambassadorship is over, he's living, you know, almost hand to mouth in this kind of sad, almost threadbare existence. And he's determined to, you know, show how his brother was used and how unfair this all was. And what he comes across, the answers he comes across, not to give anything away, but really challenge a lot of his core beliefs about both his brother and the city he's living in.
Because he thinks of his brother as perhaps being a little sloppy at times and cutting corners, but not someone who would go to this extent.
Right. He thinks of his brother as somebody who can easily be bamboozled. And to a certain degree, this was the real William O'Dwyer, too. You know, he would wander around without money, and he was very careless about certain things. But gradually, he begins to realize there's something more sinister, some kind of compromise his brother has made. And that's sort of the thing about power, too, is you do make these compromises. You do have to do sometimes even terrible things to get anything worthwhile done. But it's always this fine line, always this interesting question of where do you cross over? Where do you do something that's not justifiable?
And, of course, the sacrifice that Tom is making, which is basically he's a rescuer. That is his lot in life in many ways.
Yes, he's the rescuer. He's going to help his brother. And he's this very idealistic character like Paul O'Dwyer. He's really good. He always has a cause he's after. And it's a great thing about him. You know, at the same time, by having this affair that he's fallen into with his brother's wife, he's compromised himself in ways that he can barely live with. So there's that added dimension. You know, where does personal corruption come up against public corruption?
Why do you think this whole idea of corruption, crime, the mob fascinates us to the degree that it does?
I think it's the same allure that conspiracy theories have. We like to think there's some great network, some hidden power doing things. I mean, in a way, I think unconsciously, I think consciously it's a way of people making out that they're not naive. You know, I'm on to what's going on. Unconsciously, it gives us leave to not really participate in the democracy. You know, if it really was possible for a small group of men to kill President Kennedy 50 years ago, and we still haven't found out, then what's the point of voting, organizing, taking part in anything? You know, if the mob really is running everything, what's the point of trying to do anything? It gives us leave to kind of just forget about our democracy.
And I think what's fascinating in the book is realizing how organized crime became organized.
Yeah, and it really, you know, it really was this huge force at the time. But it would constantly kind of fall apart. But it was, you know, really down to such a business that the central mob witness in this is a member of Murder, Inc., and he turns in many of his compatriots. Murder, Inc. was an incredibly nasty, kind of amoral organization. If you ran a mob somewhere in New York or elsewhere in the country, you could call these people up and order a murder the way you'd order a pastrami sandwich. You know, for a few $100, these guys would hang out at this crazy little candy store in Brooklyn called Midnight Roses, tucked under the L in Brownsville. Still there. It's now a bodega. And you could order up a hit someplace, and these guys would go out and do it, and afterwards be completely calm about it. Afterwards, they go have a big dinner, you know. And this was, you know, peeling the lid off this was a little horrible for a lot of people.
And there is, of course, the relationship between organized crime and politics.
Yes, very much so. And really, that, as I was saying, that was really before, you know, New York politicians had this under control.
Right.
You had things like the Sullivan Law after Big Tim Sullivan, whereby you'd get a year in jail for a concealed weapon. It was a way politicians controlled gangsters. If you got out of hand, they would have you arrested, and the cop would plant a gun on you if you didn't have one on you already. You know, Prohibition gives the gangsters all this money, and they reverse everything. Now, they're kind of running things. They've taken over Tammany Hall, which is on its last legs, but it's still the big Democratic organization in the city, and they're calling the shots. And as usual with the mob, they will overreach and be brought down. But for the time being, they have this huge, pernicious influence on everything, particularly the docks in New York. Which is, you know, and this is the largest port in the world. It's where something like, you know, 40% of America's goods come in into the country. And they have this huge influence down there.
What do you think there is about this particular story that is such a New York story versus other cities like Chicago and Boston that also had these same issues going on?
Well, it is to a certain degree a universal story. I mean, that is sort of the, as we see with the Bulgers in
right.
Boston, you know, very, very similar story as we've seen in Chicago for years. This is the mob was kind of in every town, and this was sort of universal. The thing about New York was it was too big and too complex a city to ever settle into this one particular faction against another faction. You know, in Boston, it was always sort of the Irish against the old WASPs. In New York, it's, you know, there are too many players to have this little group of men continue indefinitely running things. And they don't believe it. So after the war, all these little men like Robert Moses and Generoso Pope and Cardinal Spellman and William McCormick, the very mysterious figure who runs the docks, they think they can just go on handling things as ever. But New York is too explosive, and that's always been the case. And whenever any one group tries to kind of settle in and assert its dominance, the city just, you know, kind of shakes them off eventually.
So it's your intention to write more about this in the sense of looking at post-World War II New York?
Sure. I see it as maybe the first book in a series of books. The previous books I was writing about were Times of New York in Crisis over a period of about 80 years,
right.
And I was calling that, City of Fire trilogy. This I would call the City of Gold trilogy, a time when New York was really, in many people's eyes, at its zenith, but there were these kind of fissures of corruption under it. So I want to also write about the basketball scandals, which were another huge, very indicative and poignant moment, and the quiz show scandals. You know, there were these perpetual scandals going on, it seems, in that era that would kind of, you know, tear away the idea of just how dominant and wonderful the city was.
So did they make scandals like they used to?
It's scandals now are just sex. They don't seem to have, you know, the mob element. They don't seem to have, the juiciness that we used to have. People don't have the attention span, I think, to follow a full-on political scandal as they did in those days.
In writing these stories, and especially, as you say, of thinking about looking at post-war New York, do you decide in the front end, okay, I think I can make several books out of this, or does that come in the writing of the first one?
No, that's what happened with the last one, but this time around I really felt, there are several books to be written here. I mean, it's a fabled time in New York City's history. The city is very wealthy. It's really the only great world city left unbloodied or unbowed by World War II. You know, it's dominant in all these areas, in the arts, and culture, and finance, and industry. And it's also a great middle-class city. You know, you go out for very little money and go see the greatest jazz ever. You go see Willie Mays play center field. You go into Toots Shores, which I have in there. It's an amazing saloon where everybody would hang out. And by everybody, I mean everybody. You'd see Joe DiMaggio and Ernest Hemingway together at a table. You'd see the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren in there, and Frank Costello. You'd see, in one particular night shortly after the war, Toots walks down the main aisle of his dining room, and he's got Babe Ruth and Jack Dempsey on one arm and Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra on the other. So, and you could just go out and have an evening at an affordable middle-class income, go to some place like this. Incredible. But at the same time, it was also a place where a lot of people were still excluded. You know, it was a city where if you were African-American, you couldn't live in most neighborhoods. You were excluded from the best hotels and restaurants. If you were a woman, forget about applying for most jobs. If you were Jewish and wanted to go to Columbia University, the best college in the city, it had very strict quotas on Jews, as did all the Ivy League schools at the time. You know, if you were Italian, Mario Cuomo at this point is applying to white shoe law firms. He can't get an interview because he's an Italian American. So it was a great middle class city, but restricted still. And that was not going to last in the post-war. That was kind of, those bonds were sort of being burst already. And this is what makes the period so fascinating and so transformative.
And filled with characters, as you mentioned, you have to wonder in 65, 70 years, if you were to write a novel about this period, would there be the characters with that kind of nuance to...
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if you have people that fascinating. it's like a Toots Shore as half of these, you know, individuals. You know, I don't know if you... We seem to be, in some ways, a better society, but maybe a blander society as well. I don't know if that's a problem of success, as Mayor Bloomberg describes our problems today, or if it's the fact that we're just a lot less fun.
How does nostalgia play into it? Because I would assume that that would be an issue for you as a writer, of even looking back, and saying, oh, this is what we think of this as, and this is what this really was.
Sure. And, you know, I have a tremendous nostalgia for this, not even having seen a lot of it. But I wasn't born too far from that era. I was born in 1958. So, you know, parts of that still lingered. And I there were a lot of tremendously good things about that America and that New York. You know, you had a largely unionized workforce that made a very decent middle class income. People could afford to live in the city. People were on the way up. People were going to colleges in numbers they never had before. There were a lot of good things about it. At the same time, we really forget sometimes how many people were excluded, you know, and we're not having such a good time of it. I mean, I think a lot of good things were lost in moving from that period, but on the other hand, we had to progress, and a lot was gained as well.
The new novel is The Big Crowd. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Kevin, thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. Great talking to you.
Kevin Baker is the author of The Big Crowd, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I want to thank you for joining us on the book show this week. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This show was recorded at the Argo Studios in New York City. My thanks to their team. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.